Okay, we have a quorum present, and we have three bills this morning. Senate File 278 by Representative Mann, and House File 2542, Representative Houseman, and then House File 2849, Representative Bernardi. The Houseman bill deals with housing, and the Bernardi bill, there's been a fair amount of publicity about Argosy University, so that's one that will be moving out of the committee today as well. So with that, Representative Olson, would you like to move the minutes?
Mr. Chair, I move the minutes from April 25th.
Okay, that motion is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Liebling, would you care to move the division report?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move adoption of the Health and Human Services Finance Division report for Senate File 278.
Okay, that the motion is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Liebling?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that Senate File 278, the first unofficial division engrossment, be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Rules and Legislative Administration.
Okay. Because of the deadline requirement, it does have to go to rules from this committee. We will have, we might as well take the amendment now. Representative Liebling, you want to move the amendment because this bill did go in one of the omnibus bills, but the Senate is tracking it separately, so that's why it's before us as a separate bill this morning. So if you could move the amendment, and then we'll have the bill in the order that it needs to be.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the A1-1 amendment. And I think the chair explained the reason for that.
Yeah, so we're maybe Mr. Marks can comment, but we have to make sure we don't double count the expenditure relative to the budget resolution. Mr. Marks,
Mr. Chair, this is just because the similar appropriate or the same appropriations were also in the Health and Human Services Finance Bill. So this is stating that if they would get enacted more than once, they're to be given effect only once.
Okay, so that the motion is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Mann, if you would care to explain the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House File 728 deals with the pharmacy benefit managers, or the PBMs, their licensure and transparency. Very brief overview, a pharmacy benefit manager, or a PBM, is a middleman between the drug manufacturer and the health carrier or pharmacy, essentially. They once had a role in processing prescriptions and negotiating for the lowest drug price, and this role slowly expanded, and what ended up happening is that they positioned themselves in a very lucrative space as the gatekeeper between the drug manufacturer and eventually that drug reaching the patient. And so they started requiring kickbacks or rebates from the manufacturer in order to place their drugs on a formulary that would eventually reach the patient. As you can imagine, this is a very large conflict of interest, and what we found is that money started getting siphoned out of our healthcare system and drug prices started increasing. And that's just one of the things that is going on in this system. We know that PBMs are currently taking home $10 billion nationally, and that almost 80% of the market is monopolized by three organizations. Most importantly, aside from the fact that the PBMs are siphoning money out of our healthcare system and pushing that cost to patients, is that they're making really big medical decisions that lead to real-life consequences, ER visits, hospitalizations, when formularies are changed without notice. And so what this bill does is it requires the PBMs to be licensed. Doctors, nurses, hospitals, everyone else is licensed to practice medicine in the state except for the PBMs. And it also requires their complete transparency in their dealings so that we know where our money is going. This is our fifth committee stop. I don't have any testifiers, but I'd be happy to take any questions, and Mr. Berg can answer any financial questions as well.
Okay, and we're quite familiar with Mr. Berg. He's been before the committee previously. Ms. Conley, who watches things very closely, happened to note that in the motion it was said House File. Oh.
No, in the
Oh, it was Representative Mann that said House file. Oh. Yeah, we're working with the Senate yes. file, just so, but the motions were correct. Okay, so we're all right then. Any questions of Representative Mann about the bill? Representative Hamilton.
Mr. Chairman, not a question, but a comment. I simply want to say thank you. This is much needed and long overdue. I have some personal stories as far as battles with pharmacy benefits managers, but I'm going to save those for the floor. I did share them in the Health and Human Services Finance Committee, but this is greatly needed. So thank you, Representative Mann.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Representative Liebling, would you care to renew your motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And before I do that, I also want to thank Representative Mann for carrying this bill and working so hard on it. This is a bipartisan measure. I believe that the Senate also has a lot of interest in this, and it is one of a number of measures to begin to control the cost of pharmaceuticals in our state, which is a lot of what is driving the cost of health care and also literally killing some Minnesotans. And so this is long overdue, and thank you, Representative Mann. I renew my motion that Senate File 278 as amended be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Rules and Legislative Administration.
Any further discussion? Seeing none then, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. When Representative Liebling talked about the bipartisan nature of the bill, I was reminded, I think it passed the Senate unanimously, so very strong support for the bill. So good luck in the rules.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for being here. We'll now go to the housing bill. That's Representative Houseman. And Representative Houseman, would you care to move the division report?
I move it to adoption of the Housing, Finance, and Policy Division report for House File 2542.
Okay, the motion is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. And Representative Houseman, would you care to make another motion or move the bill?
I move that House File 2542 as amended be recommended to be placed on the general register.
That motion is before us, and I see there's two amendments.
Yes, yes, Mr. Chair.
Would you care to move Amendment A9?
I will move the A9 amendment. This comes to us from MMB, Technical Corrections, to make certain that the bill can be implemented as it's intended.
Okay, any discussion on the A9 amendment? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. And Representative Houseman, then there's the A-10 amendment.
Mr. Chair, I would also move the A-10 amendment. This is not new language either. This relates to modular homes and manufactured housing, which is an emerging issue that we've spent a good bit of time on.
Okay, that motion is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Houseman.
Mr. Chair, in the Senate, they have combined both policy and finance. I had kept them separately. You voted on the finance bill on the House floor this past week. This deals primarily with tenants' protection and manufactured and modular homes and modifies the Bond Allocation Act. It's all policy. This is we passed them separately, but somehow I hope they match up in conference committee so our language can be discussed.
Okay. Any discussion? Well, Sina, would you care to renew your motion, Representative Houseman?
I renew my motion that House File 2542, as amended, be recommended to be placed on the general register.
Okay, the motion is before us. Any further discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion carried.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We now have Representative Minardi has the bill dealing with the RDC University situation. And we'll give you a chance to get to the front table.
Okay.
And, Representative Minardi, would you care to move the division report?
Sure. I move the adoption of the Higher Education
Finance and Policy Division report for House File 2849.
Okay, the motion is before us to adopt the division report. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Would you care to move the bill, Representative?
Yes. I move that House File 2849, as amended, be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Rules and Legislative Administration.
Okay, the motion is before us, and would you care to explain the bill and maybe comment briefly on why the bill is needed?
Sure. Members, we're here before you today to address and help the students who are former students of Argosy. Argosy is a for-profit institution in Minnesota that went out of business before the end of the most recent semester. These students, this helps financially the students who they will allow them to be released from their student loans that they took out for spring of 2019. There's a lot of intricacies to this because some students were told to withdraw and they withdrew, and so it addresses those types of issues, as well as the Office of Higher Ed is the experts on this, but we had hearings. Is very emotional. Kleenexes were not only distributed along for the members, they were just the pages distributed them in people that were here to talk about this. It's very emotional, and we've worked really, really hard to make our students whole and be able to get them on to, and when I say we, I'm including myself with the Office of Higher Education, but it has been a team effort because some things have been easier than others, and students, most of the students in the number of programs that they provided will be able to finish their programs through another way, and we still have like one or two more to tackle that are very specific programs. But I just want to commend the bipartisan support that we had on this. We work closely with the Republicans in the House and Democrats, as well as I asked Paul Anderson to chief author the bill in the Senate. And so we've been working to help these students as quickly as possible. So I have Commissioner Olson here today to provide some briefing as well.
Okay, Commissioner Olson, would you comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dennis Olson, Commissioner of the Minnesota Office of Higher Education. And we, too, thank Chair Bernardi and the leadership of the Higher Education Committee for agreeing to take this bill, as well as the Senate Higher Ed Committee under the leadership of Senator Anderson. This bill is critically important to the students that were displaced due to the midterm closure of Argosy University. And like Chair Bernardi said, most of the students that were displaced, over 1,000 students were impacted. Majority have found a pathway to complete their program. However, in the process of ramping up to closure, Argosy University entered court-appointed receivership, and the receiver had interest in selling the campuses to hopefully make the business whole again, and unfortunately that didn't happen, and in the process, students' financial aid that was due to them, primarily their awards over and above tuition and fees that were due to Argosy University, were not paid to the students and were utilized instead to make payroll and pay for other expenses to keep the university afloat while it was in court-appointed receivership. And so this bill provides the Office of Higher Education the authority to pay the students directly for the state financial aid awards that they are due over and above tuition and fees.
I've got a question. What happens relative to if they're not finished transferring to another institution? Will those credits transfer for the students?
Yeah, in many cases they will, and I have Ms. Betsy Talbot here as well from the Office of Higher Education who can speak to those specific pathways and opportunities where students are still struggling with some of the transfers, but for the most part, most students have found other institutions to complete their program. But, Mr. Chair and members, if I may turn it over to Ms. Talbot.
Yeah, if you heard the question, if you could comment, I was interested in making sure that the students have an opportunity to transfer their credits to another institution so that they're held harmless in that regard as well.
Chairman Carlson. I'm Betsy Talbot. I'm the Manager of Institutional Registration and Licensing at the Office of Higher Education. In short terms, I'm responsible for the state authorization of the private colleges in the state of Minnesota. So when a school closes like Argus University, it's always less than ideal when the institution closes midterm. We work very aggressively, is probably the best word, with all of our local institutions within the state of Minnesota to find transfer pathways for those students. And so there was about 34 unique programs at Argus University at the time of its closure. We have found more than one transfer pathway because we do encourage student choice for all but one program at this time. And as an explanation just for the students where the term ended in the middle of the term, there are some classes that the students were able to complete just because they kind of had some classes that were 15 weeks, some classes that were 7.5, some that were 5. And so there are transcripts, and we have those, that show the credits that they were able to complete from the term. And you get transcripts from our office for free to use those to get transfer to a new institution. If the student is not able to find a transfer pathway, then they are eligible to apply for a closed school discharge for their federal loan usage through the U.S. Department of Education. And so we're finding that students are making the choice to do that and start over in a different type of program. And some students, again, the majority of them are transferring to new institutions to complete.
Just a follow-up, do you find other institutions have been cooperative in trying to help the students that are kind of innocently caught in a situation that was not of their making?
Carlson, yes. We've been extremely appreciative of the Minn State system and our private colleges in the state of Minnesota for stepping up. They have received waivers from their accreditors for traditional transfer limitations. They've applied to their accreditors to offer new programs that they have never offered before to help these students. We even have an institution, Adler University. Adler Graduate University is offering up free space in their college to allow a Chicago institution to come in and offer a teach-out for one of the harder-to-place programs because we don't have an equivalent program in the state. So it's been really impressive in how these institutions have been so compassionate and helpful for these students. We actually held a transfer fair at the Office of Higher Education on March 15th, and we had approximately 34 schools come to help these students transfer. And we gave about several thousand transcripts out to students who came to that transfer fair, again, so they could immediately communicate with the institutions to help them transfer.
Okay, thank you. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I have a three-part question. One is, how much do we expect the total amount of relief to be for these students? B, where is the money coming from? And C, what have we done to prevent this from happening in the future? Thank you.
Mr. Olson or whoever.
Representative Carlson, Representative Scott. I'm using the fiscal note, and we have on table one on page 3, it talks about, does this bill result in additional costs for the Office of Higher Education? These students that are receiving these funds that are grant programs, they're entitlement programs where we would have been paying these funds already. And so we want to make a distinguish between the loan forgiveness program that is a flat additional cost to the agency and then the grant programs where there's a difference. So in the third column, it talks about the additional cost of $181,293. And the amounts that we're actually dispersing is $245. So I'm going to primarily talk about the additional cost column and not the amounts dispersed. So we have sources of funding for that $181,000. First is, we just discovered this week. I'm good, actually. I have a lot of memorized, thankfully. We discovered that the receiver did not cash one of the checks that we sent them to make the disbursements directly to students, and that was for approximately $7,000. And that fund, we have put a stop payment on it because now we're going to make the payment directly to the student and then we'll notify the receiver of that, that they will know that they need to, they can back that off the student account and that the fund has, the student has received that entitlement. Then the second source is that during this process of the court receivership, we discovered that the Argosy had maintained a separate kind of trust account, specifically labeled Minnesota State Grant, and that fund had $62,000 in it, and the court is holding those funds, and we are intervening in the case with the Minnesota Attorney General's Office help to retrieve those $62,000. And then the third source is, and this is primarily for the self-loan funds, is it was a violation of the participation agreement to withhold student refunds from students. And so it is a violation that we are going to try to claim on a bond. And that would, should, if we are able to successfully claim all that from the bond, we will be more than, will be made whole basically through this whole process. If that's not able to happen, we will have to use just a small percentage of reserves from the self-loan that is used to cover defaults for defaulted loans. And that's kind of how we're classifying this, just so that, again, those students can be made whole.
Representative Scott.
So wanting to know if the money should go back to the grant program to make that whole. And then just if Representative Bernardi, Chair Bernardi, could speak to what are we doing to make sure that this doesn't happen in the future with some of these private colleges.
Thanks. That's a good question.
Yes.
Both the chair and maybe Mr. Olson as well. Representative Bernardi.
Right. Thank you, Representative Scott, for that question. We were taking this as a two-step approach. We're making these students whole and helping them be able to finish out their programs first. I understand that this is not common for the institutions going out of business to have taken or have not given the students their money, and so this is a new challenge, and we are going to be addressing this over the interim on a bipartisan basis, figuring out what we can do in the future to prevent this from happening. And I've learned a lot from Betsy and Ms. Talbot and Commissioner Olson about the tricks that they do to show we follow what the federal government does to determine if it's I can't remember the word viable, sustainable, financially viable institution, and it's 2 years behind, and that we're finding out is not it's not good enough. And then when they do go through a process, as I understand, what some of these places will do is put a whole bunch of money into the account of that university to make sure that it looks like it's viable. So we're going to be addressing all these angles and coming up with probably legislation in the next, well, by next year to help prevent this in the future.
Mr. Olson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, just to reiterate that, we have committed at the Office of Higher Education to working over the interim to develop a comprehensive package. This is a one-off to provide immediate relief to those students specific to Argosy University, but we do know if this happens in the future, we want additional student protections. We also want to improve that timeline so that we have more opportunity sooner to look at financial viability scores, to work more closely with the U.S. Department of Education, and to have some additional state authorities if we find that the U.S. Department of Education process is lacking. We also do need additional bond language, probably to increase our protections to protect the taxpayer resources around state grant and other state financial aid programs. And thirdly, I would just say we need to work closely with our financial aid managers in the Office of Higher Education to make sure that we're not creating something that has unintended consequences for other students, that, you know, we know that we're addressing the issues and not creating additional problems.
And
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so the question about restoring the state grant fund with some of these, if you're able to recover some of the funds, will that be put into the state grant program where it came from?
Yeah. Representative Carlson, Representative Scott, yes. So the state grant I do anticipate to be made whole from those funds that we're going to be specifically recovering, like the stop check and the $62,000 exceeds the amount specifically that the state grant is going to have a double payment of. And so the state grant program is and the child care grant, the Minnesota GI and Minnesota Indian Scholarship are the ones that we know that we will have recovery for. And then we're having to use that resource of that bond to make the cell phone program whole.
Thank you.
Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question had to do a little bit on the order of yours with regard to the curriculum and credits. And if somebody else has a fiscal question or want to get through, I can wait till the end.
We have some on the list here, so if you want to wait, that's fine. Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure if what they started as questions. I think Representative Scott got us on a good start, so thank you for that. But they may have turned to comments instead. But I do wonder about the state's fiscal oversight of for-profit colleges. This isn't the first one that has gone belly up. This is just the current one. As I recall, I tend to think in terms of analogies. Where do we do other things that might be helpful to think about here? If I recall correctly, Chair Mariani could correct me, I'm sure, but with charter schools, I believe we require them to have a plan on what would an orderly unwinding look like. If you're going to close this charter school, who could take on those students? Who could take on the program? And I wonder if we don't have requirements that for-profit colleges have a plan like that and share it with the state, if that's a place we should go. And then, again, an analogy in, I believe it's federal labor law, we require if a company is going to do a mass layoff, that there's an orderly and a lengthy timeline so that those workers can then come to the state and apply for retraining and educational support and that sort of thing. And I wonder if there shouldn't be a requirement similarly on for-profit colleges that they give the students a heads up that we're, you know, approaching the financial shoals. And before you sign up for another semester, maybe you should know that. Because while we're dealing with the financial challenges here, both for the state and for the students, the disruption to students' education is another dimension that I think the state should be concerned about. I'm hearing from supervising psychologists who are wondering where the supply of future psychologists is going to come from, given that Argosy was a significant provider. And in a state that has a crisis with the availability of trained professionals in the mental health field, losing Argosy is a real challenge for meeting the needs of Minnesota. So I just urge that we think about the financial oversight plans for orderly unwinding, if that's what you're going to do, and timeline on that to give staff as well as students the opportunity to anticipate and make plans and avoid a crisis. Thank you.
Maybe just a quick follow-up to your question.
Sir.
We've had, in my time that I recall, two colleges that closed for whatever reason. One was in Winona, and the question there was where are the students' records and so on deposited. Mm-hmm. That was a private college. I forget the name of it, but we did find out. What was it?
St. Therese.
Okay. And we found out that the records and so on would be held, I think it was by St. Kate's up in St. Paul, but that became an important issue for students that, and it was probably went back almost to statehood, you know, so there would have been a long history of the need for records. And the other one was a junior college in Golden Valley operated by, it was affiliated somehow with Augsburg, or at least that's where the records were deposited at Augsburg. And Golden Valley Lutheran College, I think, was the title or the name of it. So the point is that it's important to have a planning process in place or some way, because I assume some of these students with Argosy who have graduated will be applying for jobs and so on. There will be a need for somebody to be able to check on their records and what their degree was and all of those kinds of things. So you're shaking your head, yes, so I assume something is being done in that regard as well. Okay, thank you. We got several people, so Representative Lilly is next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Chair Bernardi, and thank you very much for doing this. It really is I'm lucky enough to be on your committee, and I heard that testimony and what you said with the Kleenex is spot on. Hats off to the new commissioner here and his team. You've really taken this on. We liked you, at least I did, liked you already from the get-go, because that other senator or whatever he was from Minneapolis so wasn't the best. So you're doing a great job already with just replacing him. But anyways, you've really been great. And whoops, I'm getting a look from the chair. But okay, but no, this is a very serious issue. And hats off to you, Chair Bernardi, for bringing it forward. And nothing partisan about this in the least. The testimony we heard was super sad, and we're hearing some of the comments today from other members here about the, you know, just these were people that were close to getting their degrees and just to get their legs cut out from underneath them. And I mean, think about it right now, we're in May, we're probably writing some graduation letters. That's what these people were looking for doing. It was amazing, the teachers offered to teach for free, you know, to finish up. Some of them were so close, just literally hours away from getting certificates and other things, and just the brutality of this thing. And then keeping the money from the people too, like living expenses, and that these folks expected paying rent and all sorts of different things. But Chair Bernardi, thank you for bringing this forward. And we did talk about future and dealing with other issues, and I know you have plans to have hearings on that. But boy, these stories are really sad, and they really affect people, our neighbors, all in all of our communities. Nothing partisan about this in the least, but thank you, and thank you to the Office of Higher Ed.
Representative Hertas, I understand you're ready to...
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess the conversation is going a little bit direction where I wanted to go as well. It's been decades since I attended higher education institutions, but even in having attended three different colleges, I have found my experience that not always did your credits transfer, that there was always some lack of continuity. And although we strive right here to make these students financially whole with regard to the monies paid for their courses, they'll never be whole in terms of the time they've invested in getting halfway through a course or curriculum, nor the time and energy that they'll have to start over in some respects. Most recently, about a year ago, I have an adult daughter who decided to take a divergence in her career path and enrolled in a course curriculum and got all the way through it, and then found that online provider canceled one of the required courses because they didn't have enough attendees to run the course for whatever reason. And that's the explanation I've been getting, and it's now been months of an impediment to get this last requirement done to get a degree from this institution. Now, in my professional career, I'm required to take continuing education on a regular basis for a couple of different licenses that I hold. And what I notice is that the Commissioner of Commerce approves courses for continuing education, and so that it's universally accepted with regard to renewing your license. And as part of a broader discussion for those institutions that operate within our state borders, and I certainly don't discourage private colleges or private institutions from giving students more choice, but I might suggest that as we go forward, you might entertain with regard to policy that maybe colleges have to gain commissioner approval that these courses are approved for instruction and that they're transferable to any institution, that a student isn't lost in the shuffle of deciding to transfer to another school or another college and then having a lot of their work kind of go down the drain and is only unique to a certain course or curriculum that or a degree that an institution is offering. So that might be a little bit of a pathway where some of this could be resolved. And then lastly, and I think somebody touched on it already, is that there probably ought to be, with any institution, some other pathway that's established with a competitor, or whether it's state-run, that certain credits earned or whatever are fully applicable to a curriculum. and allow that person to finish up their degree and not be lost in the shuffle, because this is kind of a tragedy time. In real estate, time is of the essence. Time is money, and for people who are trying to get a degree and get an education, they've got goals. They've got they might be married students. They might have family obligations, whatever. So these are just, Chair Carlson, some thoughts that I've had about some of the inequities of really not knowing when you're signing up. You kind of blindly, especially when you're young, you're blindly think, well, this is an institution, and it'll be there as long as I'm enrolled in class. And now we're finding that there are surprises, and it's really a tragedy that somebody might have 2 or 3 years invested in a four-year degree or even in an associate degree, and then find they're basically three steps forward and two steps backwards and shuffling to start all over again. So this doesn't help getting people into the workforce. It doesn't help satisfy the needs that are there with regard to filling the great vacancies and jobs that we have. And maybe this is something that kind of look forward. So there's a little bit of uniformity, regardless of who you are as an institution, and that students can move expeditiously in getting their degree. Thank you.
Representative Ruskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just curious, Argosy, are they their nationwide institution? Is there anything of them left? And what characterize again? I heard $62,000 that you're in pursuit of. Have you exhausted all efforts to recover the taxpayer funds?
Mr. Olson or Ms. Delbert?
Representative Carlson, Droskowski, Representative Droskowski. So I'm going to give a little bit of overview of who Argus University was, because I think that's important for this committee. Argus University was part of a corporately owned school system, and they had originally four brands, but at the time of their closure, they were down to three, and their corporate owner was a holding company called Dream Center Educational Holdings. It's the acronym is DCEH, and they were national. They were in the majority of states between the Art Institute, South University, and Argus University. And they were actually a very recent purchaser of the school systems. They closed the purchase on October of 2017, which in the higher education world, that's not a very long period of time to fail, as they failed actually before. I think the interesting thing is when the new owner took over the schools, they found out very quickly that they had no money. The school was not self-supporting. It had too many liabilities, particularly leases that were very expensive, and with declining enrollment nationally, they couldn't support their overhead anymore. And with how the corporate structures were set up, they ran out of money very quickly. So 2018 was basically the year of not paying bills. And they did a very effective job of obscuring that from regulators. And in about June or July of 2018, they tried to find new purchasers of those schools. And some of them were successfully sold, and that closed on January 7th, but did not include the Argosy University brand because of its corporate structure. The other brands, each location was its own LLC, and it allowed them to get rid of those liabilities of bad leases and things that they couldn't afford anymore and that were not viable for those school systems. But they could not do that with Argus University, and they really needed to find that one purchaser of Argus University. And that obviously did not happen. And so by the time we entered into receivership, the entity was not solvent. I think they already had about $300 million in bills that they could not pay. And again, that's how financial aid got so quickly absorbed. And it wasn't until the receivership occurred and there was a lot of court oversight of the institutions themselves where they had to report these types of debts and obligations. I call receivership bankruptcy light. It's basically like we need to be protected by the court because we can't afford our bills any longer, and we need to be able to renegotiate those expenses and shed them, and then either to come back out of receivership as a successful business or be sold to a new entity minus all the liabilities. And that's where we end up finding out about those funds that were labeled Minnesota State Grant. And yes, we are doing everything that we can to make the taxpayer whole. And I hope anyone who's unfortunately been involved in the court systems, we do move very slowly. And I'm a lawyer by trade, and we've already intervened, so we're noted in the court as an interested party. And because the receivership actually was terminated on Friday due to misdeeds by the federal receiver, we have to file all of our paperwork by May 10th to get those funds. It should move fairly quickly at this point because of what's happened in the receivership to, again, to get the state whole before they enter into bankruptcy, because once they get done with that receivership on May 10th, or I think it's May 31st, they have to go into federal bankruptcy. So we want to get in there before that and get it resolved, because once things are in bankruptcy, we have a lot less control over how money is used and spent.
Representative Skousen.
Thank you so much.
And Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I also want to thank you for doing this. One of the people I work with was affected. She's been working her way with a part-time job as well as through school, and I think she was in her last semester or quarter, and I happened to be working that day with, and she was there, and we talked about how, and she was just devastated because she didn't know what to do. So I applaud the efforts. Question that I have is, are these institutions, and I understand the corporate complexity of the holding companies and so forth, but are we getting audited financial statements from them? I'm not sure which question.
Representative Carlson, is it Vogel? Yes, we do, but the problem with audited financials is they're late. They come in, let's say they run on a fiscal year like we do with June 30th, so July 1st to June 30th. And audited financials come in, you have to close out. That normally is a 30-day process. And then you have to send it to your CPA firm to get them audited, and that's probably another three-month process. So what we found with another institution that actually just closed their doors within Minnesota very quickly, they gave us 4 days' notice, is that these institutions, because enrollment is down so much, are even running out of cash between those five-month period of time. And so what we've had to do instead is, when we start seeing these red flags with declining enrollment as a trigger for us, that we start requesting quarterly unaudited financials so that we can monitor this more closely. We actually have something that we call a closed school protocol. It doesn't mean that you are closing as an institution, but we've put you in the zone of what you are highly at risk for closing. And therefore, we start doing certain requirements and monitoring steps, which includes the we need to start finding transfer pathways. What we have found with institutions is they don't call it quits fast enough. They wait until the absolute last moment. And there's one good, really good reason, is it harms students to close. Because transfer credits are a problem. Students are not able to move their credits as quickly. Institutions that negotiate transfer pathways and teach outs with institutions, they go out of date very quickly because schools change their programs very rapidly. The markets change. Enrollment demographics change. And so we're finding that those agreements don't end up being any worthwhile, which is why our office has had to step in. And we have much greater success negotiating those transfer pathways. We actually get the curriculum and academic and faculty information from the school so that we can provide that to institutions on a much more neutral basis to say, we need to help these students as a community. And so, again, schools are not calling into the last minute, and they're competitors. These are competing programs. In the moment an institution says, I might be failing, we have actually had the competing institutions go and put flyers on the students' dashboards, which is to destine the school's failure. And so we have that boundary of, they call it too late, but they don't want to call it too early because they might financially survive. And so we're trying to find that happy medium between students, for students, so that they can complete their program, but not cause harm to other students too. So we're working on it. We're trying.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the question was, 10 years ago, those of you that are sitting around the table might remember there was a slight banking crisis. I happened to experience it firsthand. And one of the interesting things back then was this confidence thing that she's talking about, because there were institutions that were in severe distress. But if the customer base was alerted to that, it became more distressful. And that was the reason for the question is, you know, just going forward, to being, to, you know, the ideal is to be able to set up a early warning system where we're getting the information financially that kind of tips us to what's going on. And as I'm listening to this explained, obviously with the new acquisition that happened, it's a little harder to follow because there was financials that were interrupted and redone. But I appreciate the efforts and just, you know, working through this stuff so that we have systems in place that are kind of able to what I would call risk rate these institutions so that we're getting the early warning and you can do the remediation hopefully before it happens or at least work through it so that the students aren't inconvenienced. So my compliments to the way you're approaching this because I can tell with the answers that you're giving that you're really trying your best and just brings back all of these memories that I wish I hadn't had. Thank you.
Something that even predates me is the bank holiday I happened to think of when you were talking about that, you know, back during the FDR years because of the concern about the run on banks and what have you during the Depression. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Being a numbers geek, Representative Vogel kind of took all my thunder, but I have a couple follow-ons. I do think that what Representative Vogel touched on, Chair Bernardi, for future consideration, just like in the banking and the financial industries, I came from that similar background, we were obligated to go under stress tests and provide those to FINRA and to other agencies of the federal ordinance that provided them with evidence that we could carry. I'm just wondering, just like a bank provides, do private colleges, private universities, much like other, along with the stress tests, are they obligated to carry reserves or some type of a bond, surety bond, that would cover the outlay from the state so that we could recover or that the students themselves could recover for the uncompleted portion of their certificate or their degree program?
Ms. Nelwood?
Representative, I can't see your name.
Albright.
Yes, and that was one of the things that Representative Bernardi kind of alluded to, is that what we're finding is that surety requirement, that reserves, well, one, we don't have a mandatory reserves requirement, which is not a bad idea. I mean, it's an option that should be explored, and that's really one of the things I love this committee hearing because we've gotten so many interesting feedback items to consider, and so there's no minimum reserve requirement like a bank would have. And what we do have is a surety requirement, and it's behind schedule by about 2 years. And so an institution is our surety requirement is tied to the U.S. Department of Education's surety requirement, which is about 2 years old. So if institutions are running out of cash too fast, we're not triggering that surety requirement. And it's a very low surety requirement. It's capped at $250,000. So we do have an institution here operating in the state of Minnesota that has a surety requirement of about $1 billion with the U.S. Department of Education to cover their losses in the event the institution closes. But ours is $250,000. That's slightly problematic for obvious reasons, because we know if you have a population of 40,000 students, you can imagine how little of a refund that they would get. We would probably pay more in postage and to process a check than the student would receive. And we did attempt to try to increase that. Things are different now. Maybe we can try to do that again in the future, is to eliminate or change that cap. But we also have to have better mechanisms, like with the stress test, to trigger that surety requirement and not just waiting for the feds to tell us that there's a problem, because it's just too far behind. And we have an institution where that's exactly what happened. They ran out of money so quickly, and it's not Argosy, that the feds are just now asking for that surety requirement, but the school can't afford to get it. And they got delisted from NASDAQ for being a penny stock because they ran out of money so quickly. And that's not a system that is effective for our students and for our schools, actually.
Mr. Chair, it seems like all the signs were there well in advance, and unfortunately it sounds like it was a kind of a the old movie, you know, what we have here is a failure to communicate, you know, with the students. And I think picking up on some of the things that have gone on, you mentioned the Federal Department of Education and higher ed is the commissioners at the table here. I'm just wondering if the AG's office has been engaged in this process, because this is a litigious environment with recovery. And you mentioned audited financials, and I'm just wondering, it seems like there's this kind of fog misting around Argosy in terms of mismanagement of the funds that were provided to them by the state of Minnesota. And so I'm just wondering, not to cast aspersions, but it almost seems like there is a, not criminal, but a civil infraction of the law, and that's why I bring up the AG's office, and I'm just wondering, has that office been engaged, or will they soon be?
Ms. Belvin?
Representative Carlson, yes, the AG's office. I'm very grateful for the relationship our office has been able to form with the Consumer Financial Protection Division, who would be responsible for enforcing these types of issues, and we do have very frequent meetings with them. And including whether we should be, we have enough evidence to provide them as a platform to move forward with other litigation. Obviously, with recovery is going to be challenging, and they get to weigh that, because this institution is heading to bankruptcy, and they are so broke. Obviously, you can move up in the priority. If there are intentional acts that caused these things to occur. And so, yes, they are absolutely looking at those things. We've been in constant communication. We actually were in communication with them. Once we have that risk analysis happening, we immediately communicate with them so that they also know if students are complaining to them, what's going on, and that they can work with us and ask us for what they need from our records in order for their purposes.
Mr. Chair, this is just kind of an esoteric question from a bankruptcy perspective, but the asset list for Argosy or the parent company of Argosy, have measures been taken to seize or freeze the assets so that they can't be sold off in terms of the subordination to the creditors themselves?
Representatives, we have not been able to do so because of the federal receivership. The receivership gives a lot of power and control of the receiver to control the assets and enter into contracts and just pretty much do whatever they want with the money. It is one of the reasons why the receivership is actually being terminated, because they don't have those orders of priority in the receivership like they do in bankruptcy. It's one of the reasons why the court wanted to terminate it earlier, but for some unwinding issues of the schools that just got sold in January. And so we've been blocked from that type of activity. And the court recognizes that that was not appropriate any longer, and that we institutions and other entities, other states who actually are owed money to, need to be able to come in and get access to resources and assets.
Mr. Chairman, so are you suggesting that this was a receivership filed in state court or federal
court?
Representatives, it was filed in Ohio federal court. And does that answer your question?
I'm just wondering if Minnesota is a party to that receivership, and when did that occur?
Ms. Belvin?
We did file as an interested party and as permission for our AG's office to intervene already. And that happened pretty early on in the process, just because basically once the school actually announced its closure, before that, our office was trying to communicate with the receiver and the schools to make students whole. We became aware of the what this bill is about, that students weren't receiving their money. At the end of January and early of February, so we were going through the prescribed statutory, administrative action process. And then when the receiver and the school actually closed on March 8th, that is when we kind of entered into the mode of recovery and trying to resolve how we can make students whole.
Well, thank you, and I apologize if you've covered this while I had to step out, but I'd like to go back to the issue of students and them getting placed. Do you have any idea how many students had to go out of state to find resources or a school that could help them their education?
Representative Torkels, it depends on the program. Their RGC, one of their distinctions and what made them successful in the Twin Cities is their unique health science programs. And they were mostly at the undergraduate level and also at the graduate level for health sciences. And, for example, they had one of the largest for histotechnology, which is an associate degree program that's needed by hospitals, and also sonography, dental hygiene, and those students were very hard to place. The histotech students are, some of them are going through UND, some of them were able to go to Mayo. We have four students who have not been able to be placed at this time from that program. We ended up having to bifurcate students on where they were going based on how far they were in their program. We found a lot of institutions, like for radiation therapy, because we have two schools who want to offer it now for new, which will help place those students and teach them out. But students who are right at the end of their program, they're not leaving the state, but they're doing them remotely. And then so it's kind of a mix. Like, they're attending out-of-state institutions, but they're doing it remotely. And then other students, because it took some time for this ID program, it's the doctorate in clinical psychology. We just had two institutions announce that they're going to try to come to the state, and one of them is already in state. It's Augsburg University. It's going to offer that program for the long term, not just teach out the currently enrolled students. But it took time. I mean, it's February. Is it May 1st?
Today, yeah.
Yeah, okay. What was the target time? It's May Day. Okay, so it's May 1st, and the school closed March 8th, and we already had students in that program because there was no other option in the state of Minnesota to sell their houses and try to move to out of state, and that's never the ideal. But so there are students, yes, who are leaving out of state. We'll be able to run a report probably late fall once the data starts coming in, the enrollment data, to find out where these students landed, and if it is out of state, we won't necessarily have that data because we don't get enrollment data from out of state. But we do hope to know, you know, who went on to graduate or who went on to transfer, and how many unknowns we have, which would be distributed between students who didn't go on and enroll anywhere or they enrolled out of state.
Thank you. Just a brief follow-up. So does the department take a role in that in helping the students and helping to kind of facilitate that negotiation between the student and a potential institution that might be able to finish their degree or get them into a program and avoid taking advantage of them in the process?
Ms. Nolan.
Representative Carlson, Representative Torkelson, yes. Whether it should be our lane, I'm not sure. But we do it because it's in the best interest of students, which is why we collect all that academic information, and hopefully none of the private institutions are mad at me in the state, but I'm pretty aggressive in contacting them and getting them to look at the curriculum and help these students transfer. We publish them on our website. I also get student contact information, and I'm able to send targeted emails to all students. So a school will approach me and say, hey, I'm offering a teach out for this business program. And I'll say, great, I'm going to just prepare what you want me to say to the students, and then I will email it to all of the students who are in that program. And that way, they have the information live when it becomes available. They can also keep checking our website. And then if the schools ever have questions about the curriculum or what would be in the best interest of students and how to place them, they do communicate with us on a regular basis, because in this case, there was not a surviving institution to communicate with. And so normally this should have been done by Argosy. This should have been done by DCEH. But we find, again, they're calling it too late in the game, and they don't leave enough resources for them to the schools themselves, as obligated by the accreditor and the U.S. Department of Education and our office to do it. So we just assume that role on their behalf.
Rep. Parkinson, thank you. Rep. Tim Scott.
Just one last question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know, you know, if you're out of school in March and you can't get in to another school for more than a six-month period of time, your student loans start kicking in. Is there any deferment plan that's in place for these kids or these students?
Ms. Delvin.
Representative Carlson, Representative Scott, what's interesting about this case is yes and no. The department actually discharged all of their spring aid, every student. And so if they had loans from spring semester, they no longer have those loans. But if they had loans from a prior term, which many of them do, they do technically go into repayment, but they can request a hold. They can request basically a forbearance. After that, the goal is always to get them placed before those 6 months occur. We do have a couple of programs because they're cohort-based, like you just start day one, and then the next year, the group two comes, and those are the students who are going to be the most problematic. And that, for example, that's the dental hygiene program, and those students are going to have to request a discharge or a forbearance. Some of those students are going to have to start over, like it doesn't make any difference financially if they start over or not because of the loss of income versus the loss of credits. And so those students, we do provide them that advice to also they could explore applying for a closed school discharge and get those loans just wiped out if they have to restart the program anyways, because it's just financially advantageous to get to have those loans discharged.
CNN, would you? Representative.
Thank you for the indulgence, Mr. Chair. Just one question is occurring to me as you talk about discharge of loans and like, are students going to run the risk of a negative impact on their credit score because of any of the financial implications in this?
Ms. Delvin.
I might need some clarification. If a student does not work with their servicer and kind of ignores the paperwork they get after the 6 months, absolutely.
Right.
As long as they stay in communication with us, even though we have no impact on those federal loans, we're giving them what advice about what they need to do and referring them to their loan servicer, they can avoid all of those problems. We have heard from many students that the closed school discharges are already being processed. So that's really good that they're getting ahead of the game. And I will say that pros and cons, the current administration at the federal level is prioritizing these Argosy student claims because there's 100,000 plus claims from the prior school closures like Corinthian and ITT that haven't been processed, but they are processing the Argosy ones right now.
Okay. Thank you. It was just another dimension of the thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, ma'am.
Representative Albright.
Representative Dabney brought up a good question, and I know that in terms mean very different things to the tax man. And so whether a loan is forgiven or discharged, it means very much a key difference when you're filing your tax return in the year in which that loan was discharged or forgiven, whether or not you're going to receive a 1099. If you want to rub salt in the wound for these people, you better not show that as an income receipt to those folks at the end of the year. So I just want to alert you to that, make sure that we are making sure that these folks who have been really, really harmed are not paying over and above, and that discharge is not included as an income on their 1040.
Ms. Albright.
Representative Carlson, Representative Albright. The good news is this week it came up for the cell phone issue because we're discharging the cell phone. There is a specific USC that a closed school discharge or an unpaid refund discharge is not taxable. And so that is very clear under federal law that any of these discharges that students have received is not a taxable event at the federal level.
And, Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, the language in the bill specific to the Minnesota self loan does have the term reverse, which we believe does not include tax impact to the students, and can't 100% guarantee that, but have written the language in such a way that will greatly reduce the tax impact to students, if at all.
Okay, any further discussion? Ms. Bernardi, would you like, or Representative Bernardi, would you like to do your motion?
Yes, I will. I'd like to do that, but I just want to just pause for a moment, and you can what an amazing public servant we have here with Betsy Talbot. She has gone above and beyond, and has really made a difference in the lives of these students when they face these marriage year challenges. So I want to give credit for that and thank her for all of her work.
I will second that. In fact, just a side conversation a couple of moments ago that I had with Ms. Conley to my right, I said I was really pleased as to how you seem to be on top of this whole situation, the agency, Mr. Olson, but Ms. Talbot in particular, who did most of the testifying here today, you seem to be very much on top of the issue, and thank you for that. Mm-hmm. The motion.
I renew my motion that House File 2849, as amended, be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Rules and Legislative Administration.
Okay, and just for the benefit of the committee, after it goes to rules, it will need to go to government operations, and I've already had a conversation with Representative Freiberg, so he knows it's on the way. So with that, any further discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Carlson and members.
The we will likely be meeting next week. We're watching the floor activity closely, and we have to match the activities in this committee with the floor schedule. So watch for announcements about when we'll be meeting next week, because we do have some legislation that we'll have to move out of committee yet. So with that, meeting adjourned.